Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We have looked at the second different list of 10 topics that is given in the 12th canto spoken by Suta Goswami. We identified that these are the special list of topics for a Mahapurana, that a lesser Purana just has to have only 5 topics, and that the other Puranas that seem to be Mahapuranas are not on the same standard as the Bhagavatam because they focus on the minor topics more. Now we're up to 62. Atasargadi nam lakshanam aha. Avyakrita gunakshoban mahatastri vrito hamaha. Bhuta matindriyartanam sambhavak sarga uchyate. Pradana gunakshoban mahan tasmat triguno hankadas tasmad bhutar matranam bhuta sukshmanam indriyanam cha stula bhutanam cha tadupalakshita tadevatanam cha sambhavaha sargaha karana shrishtihi sarga ityardaha. Now the topics of creation and so on are defined. From the agitation of the original modes within the unmanifest material nature, the Mahatattva arises. From the Mahatattva comes the element false ego, which divides into 3 aspects. And from this threefold ego comes the subtle sense objects, the senses and the gross sense objects. The generation of all of these is called creation, sarga. And now, this is the commentary on that verse. That's the translation. Here's the commentary. The Mahatattva arises from the agitation of the original state of material nature, pradhan, which consists of the unmanifested modes. From that Mahatattva comes false ego in each of the 3 modes, from which arise the subtle sense objects, the senses, and the gross elements, as well as the demigods, who are implied without being mentioned. In other words, sarga is the sending forth, srishti, of the causal elements. Purushanugrahitanam etesham vasanam maya visargo yam samaharo bijad bijam characharam. Purusha paramatma etesham mahad adinam jivasya purva karma vasana pradano yam samaharaha karyabhutas charachara prani rupo bijad bijam eva prava apanno visarga uchyate vyashti shrishtir visarga ityartaha anen otir apyukta. Impelled by the desires of the living entities and given help, kind help, by the Purusha, these elements combine, making moving and non-moving life forms appear, like seeds producing more seeds. This is called Visarga. The Purusha is the Supersoul. Visarga is the name of the conglomeration of, quote, these elements, the Mahatattva and so on, a conglomeration directly brought about by the residual desires carried over by the jivas from previous karma. The secondary creation is the coming forth of moving and non-moving forms of life, flowing in a perpetual current, thus appearing in cycles the way one seed comes forth from another. That is to say, Sarga is Vyashti, the sending forth of the individual beings. By implication, this description also includes the topic, creative urges. Okay, please come to class on time. This class begins at 9 o'clock. And we have in the morning our regular Bhagavatam class that is scheduled to begin at 6:30, and almost nobody is there at 6:30, sometimes nobody. This is disrespectful to the Bhagavatam. Okay? So, the definition of the first two topics, Sarga and Visarga, is given here by Shukadeva Goswami, Suta Goswami. There is the glance of Mahavishnu on Prakriti that begins the process, but then, as the result of that agitation, that imbalance of the components of nature, nature has those three modes, and the modes, first the mode of goodness becomes a little over-dominant, and then the mode of passion, and then ignorance. And that sets the evolution, the transformation into action, this imbalance. So Mahatattva is the same Prakriti, called Pradhan originally, but in it, the modes begin to become manifest because they lose their perfect equilibrium and become separately manifest. And then false ego appears in each of those three modes. And the false ego in goodness, passion, and ignorance each become the basis of the causation, the manifestation of all the elements of creation, including the physical elements, the subtle perceptions of those, the basic perceptions of those elements, just like there's ether, and then there is sound. Not any particular sound, but just the subtle existence of sound, sound per se. That comes before. Then the ether manifests. First the tanmatra, and then the physical element, and then the sense organ, and then the demigod who controls the organ. So they're all in different forms of false ego in the three modes, coming from these forms of ahankar. The manifestation of all those elements is all included within the scope of Sarga, the primary creation, which is done by Mahavishnu in conjunction with Prakriti. The Visarga, this definition does not mention Brahma, but it's known from the other definition and from so many other descriptions that the prime agent in the Visarga is the creature of Lord Mahavishnu. Brahma. But as this verse describes, the second verse we read now, the Supersoul, who is actually in this case Garbhodakshay Vishnu, the second Vishnu, Purusha, he's the Supersoul of the whole universe. So that Supersoul is giving his empowering Lord Brahma and the demigods and the elements to manifest everything visible, everything in material existence. Okay, let me read the commentary. There is another part with another commentary. But there's so there's two. Well, actually, it goes on up to 62.6, and there's only a commentary on this second part. Sri Sutta's definition of secondary creation does not explicitly mention the secondary creator Brahma, but Srila Baladeva Dibhushan, in his commentary on the Tattvasandarbha, points out that the word Purusha hints at Brahma's involvement in the Visarga. Srila Jiva identifies this Purusha as the Paramatma. The Supreme Lord takes the role of the Supersoul only when the finite souls enter material existence and need to be supervised. In the spiritual kingdom, Vaikuntha, the Paramatma is not present because there is no need for him. The first finite soul born into the material creation is four-headed Brahma, and he does his work of creation because he is Purusha Anugrahita, inspired by his creator. The supersoul of the total universe, Garbhodaka Shai Vishnu. Okay, continuing. Vitir Bhutani Bhutanam Charanam Acharani Cha Krita Swena Nvinam Tatra Kamat Chodanayapiva. Charanam Bhutanam Samanyato Acharani Cha Karat Charani Cha Kamad Vritihi Tatra Tunvinam Swena Swabhavena Kamat Chodanayapi Vayaniyata Vrittir Jivika Krita Sa Vrittir Uchite Ityartaha. This is definition of vritti. Okay. You know, I think I'm taking Prabhupada's translation here. I have a problem. Yes, vritti does correspond to the in the other list, stanam, or general maintenance. But the verse, this verse doesn't mention that. Doesn't say anything about sustenance or maintenance. Prabhupada has read that in there. I think that's taking liberty that we should not indulge in. Here, we should be more literal. There actually is no mention of sustenance. There is no mention of sustenance in the Sanskrit. Well, it just says vritti is like this. Vritti, hold on a second. I put it in the wrong color. Oh, okay. Well, I mean, you want me to come up with another translation? It's like not. It's not here saying vritti means such and such. It's saying vritti is that is vritti is the vritti of the Buddhas and of the Charas. Okay, no, it's like this. The vritti of the Buddhas are other Buddhas. The vrittis of the Chara are the Acharas. And that vritti for human beings, that vritti is done by one's own desire or else by following injunctions. That would be some sort of literal translation. It doesn't say in the Sanskrit, vritti means the process of sustenance. That's true, but Prabhupada's taking the liberty to read that in. Yes. It's not even Prabhupada's translation. Because it's from the 12th canto. Okay, well, I may have pulled it out of the commentaries, or I may have just taken the liberty myself. which case there's no offense done in undoing it. But I made a note that we shouldn't say that here because it's not there in the Sanskrit. Maybe it's there in Sri Swami's commentary, but it's not in the Sanskrit. I mean, I don't see, even in our vritti here, our little two lines of commentary underneath, there's also no mention of sustenance. Of course, it is sustenance. It corresponds to sthanam. But it's not said here, that's all. Yes. Well, as I said, vritti, livelihood, means of living, means of livelihood. Because the first sentence is the Buddhas are the means of livelihood of the Buddhas. It means one living entity lives, maintains his life by another living entity, by eating another living entity. And especially the moving ones eat the non-moving ones. So it means of livelihood. Okay, you can translate it as sustenance. But that first sentence isn't really there. So I'd rather be more close to what the Sanskrit's actually saying. Yes. Well, see, sustenance as... No, but sthanam is how the Supreme Lord sustains the living entities. But when you say vritti, you mean how the living entities manage to support themselves. You know, you can conceive of vritti without any idea of the Supreme Lord being behind the scenes. It's like, you know, what do you do for a living? I'm an accountant. What does that have to do with the Supreme Lord? You know, okay, the Supreme Lord has empowered you to be an accountant. That's the higher philosophy. But just saying that you make a living by being an accountant isn't focusing at all, isn't giving attention to the involvement of the Supreme. But what the word sustenance, as we used it in the previous list, sthanam, that means how the Lord arranges for everybody's maintenance. So it's a different idea. They're equivalent. I mean, the amounts are the same thing. But I'm just saying that part of it is the Supreme Lord. Nothing's mentioned about the Supreme Lord providing anything here in this particular verse. So I don't want to read into the verse what's not there. No, translate just means of livelihood. Translate it like that. I'll translate it as means of livelihood. And I think that's more fair, because the word vritti doesn't... Sthana is one thing, but vritti is another. Sthana is how the Lord makes arrangements for us. Vritti is just what we do to live. Okay. I didn't read the translation beyond that first sentence. Let me try again. The word vritti... parenthesis, I'm going to retranslate it. Means of livelihood is non-moving beings for the moving beings. And for a human being, his means of livelihood is carried out either by his own desire or by compliance with the Vedic injunctions. Take that translation. Now, the gloss on it. For moving beings, the means of livelihood, that's what I said there, vritti, generally consists of sustenance upon unmoving beings. Or from the word cha, meaning and, moving beings also. Okay, because we have lots of moving beings eating other moving beings. We have tigers chasing deer. So there's no absolute rule that moving beings can only eat unmoving beings. That's implied by the cha. For the moving beings, the food is the unmoving beings, cha, also other moving beings. More specifically, for human beings, what is called vritti consists of the regulated means of living they carry out according to their own natures. Swabhavata, is that word there? Swabhavena is there in the Sanskrit. By their own natures, whether by desire or by scriptural rules. Which is better? Yeah. Yeah. The more civilized people follow scriptural rules, the less civilized people just follow their desire. People in the middle try to follow a little of each. Okay. Continuing. These are simple definitions. There's not much philosophical, convolutions that we have to untangle here. Rakshachu chavatariha vishwasyanu yuge yuge tuyang martyarshi deveshu hanyante yaistrayi dvishaha yair avatarayish anain eshakata stanam poshanam cheti trayam uktam. In each age, the infallible Lord appears in this world among the animals, human beings, sages, and demigods. By his acts in these incarnations, he protects the universe and kills the enemies of Vedic culture. This is called Raksha. The word Yai means by these incarnations. Here the three other topics, sustenance, maintenance, and narrations about the Lord, are implied. Okay, those other topics. Sustenance, maintenance. Sustenance, maintenance, and narrations about the Lord go under the topic of Raksha, according to this. That's what Guru Sevananda was saying, and he got it from here. Okay. Correction on what I said. The three topics that are not on the list, sustenance, maintenance, and narration, are covered by the one topic, raksha, protection. Of course, special protection is there for the devotees, general protection for everybody else. And he's doing raksha in his incarnations, his pastimes also. Well, we shouldn't call vritti sustenance. If sustenance belongs under raksha, we shouldn't translate vritti as sustenance. That's confusing. Okay. I think we can just move on to the next one. Other definitions of the other topics. Manvantaram manur deva manuputra sureshvaraha Vishayom Shavatarascha Harekshad Vidam Uchyate Manvari Acharana Katanena Sadharma Evatra Vivakshita Ityartaha Tatascha Praktana Grantain Aikartyam. Sadharma was on the second canto list? Manvantara. No, in the definition of Manvantara given in the second canto, last chapter, that was the definition. Sadharma is the definition of Manvantara, the spiritual principles of religion. Anyway, this verse is translated, in each reign of Manu, these six appear as manifestations of Lord Hari. Okay, they're all manifestations of Lord Hari. The ruling Manu, the chief demigods, Manu's sons, Indra, the great sages, and the partial incarnations of the Lord. Implied here is that the narrating of the acts of Manus and others is meant to tell of transcendental religious principles, as Shukadev made explicit in the last chapter of the second canto. So it's implied, it's not said outright here, but it's also implied. And so this verse has the same meaning as the verse cited before, which is Bhagavatam 2:10:4, the definition of Manvantara in the second canto. The meaning is equivalent to just something that's said explicitly there and only implied here about the Manus. In the reign of the Manus is significant because under the auspices of the Manus, the principles of religion are established. Manu, Svayambhava Manu, is the maker of the laws for human race, and the subsequent Manus also organize human society by giving them their religious principles. And then the last part. Ragyam brahma-pasutanam vamshastraikalikonvayaha vamshanucharitam tesham vittam vamshadaraschaye tesham ragyam ye vamshadaras tesham vittam vamshanucharitam. This is a explanation of what the verse means, but actually every single word in the explanation is there in the verse. That's why it's all in italics. It's just reordering the words in a more normal order. So, translation, dynasties are lines of kings that issue forth from Lord Brahma and extend through past, present, and future. The accounts of such dynasties and their most prominent members is called dynastic history. Accounts of these kings and the deeds of their royal families, members, are called Vamshanucharita. Okay. And the Vamshanucharita fits as a subcategory of Ishanakata, according to the second canto's definition. Ishanakata is a description of the pastimes of the Supreme Lord and his great devotees. And in the Bhagavatam, there are a number of great devotees described. Some of them are sages, but most of them are kings in these two dynasties. It's just the chosen style of the Bhagavatam to focus on description of these kings in these two dynasties, because what kings do tends to be interesting. What brahmanas do is boring. It doesn't make a good narration. They just sit there and meditate and go back to Godhead. So what? It's not exciting. It's not interesting. But what the kings do is interesting. That is Vamshanucharitam, and that is a good part of the Ishanakuta that was mentioned in the second canto. There is more description of devotees than of, I don't know if you count the verses, I think still there's more verses, more chapters describing devotees than there are chapters describing the Lord himself and his avatars, even counting the 10th canto. There are 33 avatars described. There are 4,000 verses describing, or 4,000 verses in the 10th canto and more verses elsewhere describing Krishna, and 30 other avatars who each have a chapter. But still, that still makes less than half of the Bhagavatam. And other parts of the Bhagavatam are about devotees of the Lord. Mostly kings. These dynasties extend not just in the past, but in the present and the future. We have description in the 9th canto of how the dynasties go on into the future. Predictions of future kings. And in the 8th canto, there's description of future Manus. So the future, the present and future, is also described. The dynastic history of the present and future is also described in the Bhagavatam. Okay, we're moving now into the very last anuchet. Was there for 62 there was something, or just for 63 in the Sarvasambandhani? Let me open the file. Okay, so we don't get it yet. There's a long description about the annihilation, pralaya. Okay, 63, so we'll get to that. We'll start 63 now, which actually just continues the list and the definition of each item. 63.1. Naimittika prakritiko nitya adhyantiko layaha samsteti kavibik proktash chaturdasya svabhavataha asya parameshwarasya svabhavitap shakti tataha adhyantika ityanena muktir apyatra praveshita. There are four types of cosmic annihilation: occasional, elemental, continuous, and ultimate, all brought into effect by the inherent potency of the Supreme Lord. Learned scholars have called this topic dissolution. Of him means of the Supreme Lord, and by his nature means by his energy, svabhavataha. So svabhava means own character or nature. But when reference to the Supreme Lord, that means it's being done by his personal energies. The word ultimate implies that included herein is the topic liberation. Okay? Liberation is missing from the list, but is implied here, especially since we define four kinds of laya right here in this verse, and Atyantika is the fourth one. That's ultimate annihilation, but it's the annihilation of the subtle body of the living entity, and which is his liberation. Hetur jivos yasar gadhir. Well, okay, because we're talking about dissolution. Good. Well, let's dive into the dissolution. Okay. Well, let's at least start reading it. Pralaya lakshanam aha naimitika iti. Okay, this is a commentary on what we just read. Annihilation is defined in the text beginning naimitika. That was the verse from the 12th canto. Esham lakshanam dvadashe chatur adhyaye anusandeyam. Palayastu manvantarante pibhavati. Yata Sri Vishnu Dharmotare pratamakande. The characteristics of the kinds of annihilation mentioned can be found in the fourth chapter of the 12th canto. That's where you have a whole chapter describing the four kinds of annihilation. One of the very last instructions given by Shukadev. An annihilation also occurs at the end of each reign of Manu, as stated in the first khanda of the Vishnu Dharmotara Purana. And there's a long narration here. Nothing very puzzling, but it's a little extensive. I'll start reading it. Vajra uvacha. Vajra is Krishna's great-grandson, Vajranaba. He's speaking to Maitreya, and Maitreya is going to answer his question. Vajra uvacha manvantare pirikshene yadrishi dvija jayate samavasta mahabhaga tadrishim vaktum arhasi markandeya uvacha manvantare pirikshene Deva Madvandareshwaraha Maharloka Matasadhya Tishtanti Gatakalmashaha Manuscha Sahashakrena Devascha Yadunandana Pamalokam Prapadyante Punar Avriti Durlabam Vishayas Chatata Sapta Tatra tishtanti te sada adhikaram vina sarve sadrisha parameshtinaha bhutalam sakalam vajra toyarupi maheshwaraha urmi mali mahavegak sarvam avritya tishtati Burlokam ashritam sarvam tada nashyati vyadavo navinashyanti rajendra vishuta kulaparvata. So there were four kinds of annihilation defined in the verse quoted from the 12th canto. 12th canto, chapter, what is it? Chapter 7. That there's naimitika, prakritika. Those are the first two kinds. Naimitika is occasional, And Prakriti is final, total annihilation of the whole universe. The occasional one is understood as occurring at the end of every day of Brahma. But Jiva Goswami here is going to try to establish by quoting from what? The Vishnu Dharmotara? That there's also partial annihilation at the end of every manvantara, or at least the end of some manvantaras. Okay, and that's why he's citing this quotation, to show a description of annihilation at the end of the reign of Manu. Okay? Okay, every single Manu. Yeah, then there's some other times, even in between Manus, even in the middle of a Manu, there's sometimes some kind of annihilation. Special annihilations. There's one at the end of every Manu. Every Manu reign. Okay. An annihilation also occurs at the end of each reign of Manu, as stated in the first kanda of the Vishnu Dharmotara Purana. We don't have a table of contents in the Vishnu Dharmotara Purana, but it's supposed to be there in the first canto somewhere. Vajra said, O learned Brahmana, most fortunate one, please explain to me the state of affairs that develops when a reign of Manu is over. Markandeya said, when a reign of Manu is over, the demigods who rule it achieve Maharloka, where they live sinlessly. Manu, along with Indra and some other demigods, O son of the Yadus, reaches Brahmaloka, from which return to the lower worlds is unlikely. The seven great sages also take up permanent residence there, with no official positions, and live like Lord Brahma. The Supreme Lord, O Vajra, then assumes the form of water, great in power, and garlanded by waves, and covers the entire surface of the earth. Everything sheltered by the earth is then destroyed, O Yadava. But not destroyed, O King of Kings, are the famous principal mountains. Here the principal mountains are Mahendra, Malaya, and others. That's a little bit of commentary. And my commentary is, the official sages and demigods hold a regular term of office for one manvantara, or reign of Manu, after which, though they do not necessarily die, they give up their positions. They may go to play other roles in the next manvantara, but first they are replaced with a new Manu, new official sages and new demigods. Then, continuing the text in Sanskrit, there's one more big chunk of it. Shesham vinashyati jagat stavaram jangamam chayat naur bhutva tu mahi devi tada yadukulod bhava darayat yatabhi jani sarvanyeva visheshitaha akarshati tutam navam stanat stanam tulilaya Karshamanam tutam navam deva devam jagatpatim stuvanti vishayak sarve divyai karmavir achyutam gurnamanas tatamatsyo jalavegormi sankule gurnamanam tutam navam nayat yamita vikramaha Himadri Shikari Navam Badwa Devo Jagatpatihi Matras Matsyas Twadvishyo Bhavati Te Chattishtanti Tatragaha Kritatulyam Tada Kalam Tavat Prakshalanam Smitam Apakshamam Mato Yanti Yatapurvam Naradipa Vishayas chamanus chaiva sarvam kurvanti te tada manvantarante jagatam avasta mayerita te yaruvindanata atakparam kim tavakirtaniyam samasatas tadvada bhumipala. Translation, the rest of the world, with its moving and non-moving creatures, is destroyed. But then the goddess Earth becomes a boat, O descendant of the Yadu family. She carries every single kind of seed. And the Supreme Lord playfully pulls that boat from one place to another. As the Lord of Lords, Master of the Universe, pulls the boat along, all the sages praise the Infallible for his splendid deeds. Then the immeasurable, valorous Lord Matsya, wandering about in the water full of powerful waves, directs the wandering boat. Tying the boat to a peak of the Himalayas, the Supreme Lord Matsya, the Master of the Universe, then becomes invisible, and the creatures who were on the boat find themselves standing on the peak. That time becomes just like the Krita Age, and it is known as the time when all has been cleaned. The water becomes then calm, just as before, O ruler of men, and the sages and Manu all begin to perform their duties. Thus I have described to you, O master of all Yadus, the state of the worlds at the end of a reign of Manu. What else shall I now relate to you? Please tell me in brief, O king. So we had a description in the last chapter of the eighth canto of the Bhagavatam of the appearance of Lord Matsya at the end of the sixth, the Chakshusha Manvantara, preceding the current Manvantara, and the person who is going to become Vaivasvata Manu in the next Manvantara is involved in that pastime. But the same similar event happens at the end of every Manvantara, something, some annihilation. Maybe not Matsya appearing, but some annihilation occurs at the end of every Manvantara. Commentary. The more familiar kind of partial annihilation of the universe is that which occurs at the end. I think I have to have the word the. At the end of each of Brahma's days, when Brahma goes to sleep. This Naimittika Pralaya is described in many Puranas and other scriptures. Tamo Matram Upadaya Pratisamruddha Vikramaha Kalenanugata Shesha Aste Tushnim Dinatyaye. At the end of the day of Brahma, under the insignificant portion of the mode of darkness, the powerful manifestation of the universe merges into the darkness of night. By the influence of eternal time, the innumerable living entities remain merged in that dissolution and all is silent. Tamevan vapidiyante loka bhur adayastrayaha nishayam anuvrittayam nirmukta shashibhaskaram. When the night of Brahma ensues, all the three worlds are out of sight, and the sun and the moon are gone, just as in the due course of an ordinary night. Trilokyam dahyamanayam shaktya sankarshanagnina yant ushmana maharlokaj janam brigvadayor ditaha. The devastation takes place due to the fire emanating from the mouth of Sankarsana. And thus great sages like Bhrigu and other inhabitants of Maharloka transport themselves to Janaloka, being distressed by the heat of the blazing fire that rages through the three worlds below. That's from the third canto of the Bhagavatam. His description of the annihilation at the end of Brahma's day. Okay, there's some more, but we'll read that tomorrow. There's not even much left of the final Anucheda of the Wholesome Dharma. Yes?
It's about
Let me find it. Now you're talking about the translation, right? Which verse is it? How does it start? Sorry, I don't see Paramesh-D right here. Is it back in file 14? File 11? Okay, Paramesh-D na. Yeah, I took it as an aluk samas. Paramesh-D-N. Sti is the person who's situated on the top. So it's locative. It's a samasa. Yeah, but actually, this is more correct. It's actually a samasa. Why shouldn't it be split? As a rule, we should break samasas. And in earlier years, we didn't see that it was a samasa. That was our mistake. I think I have. I have in my copy, at least. Yeah, because they, what can I do? The BBT goes ahead and prints it without showing it to me, and I have no chance to check it. I went through the whole text of the Bhagavatam and made a revised transliteration, and BBT's never used it. What can I do? Okay. We'll continue and probably finish up the Sundarbha tomorrow. Please, questions, send them to me and we'll discuss them first thing in the morning if you have any questions. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Sri Tattva Sundarbha Ki Jai.